Yo, I'm gonna sign up for this and we're gonna go up against these chefs.
Chef Jose, AKA the Trill Cooker.
So there was this competition out there at the time. It was called Culinary Fight Night. A few other chefs were part of it that had been on TV. I'm line cook at New York Presbyterian. And what made it worse was one of the chefs that I brought on with me wasn't even a chef. It was my wife's cousin, Gary. And we go up against Chef Kelvin in the championship round. Well-seasoned executive chef, and we end up winning.
How's he feel about that?
Oh, he was torn. From doing dinners for 8 guests in my house to cooking for Jennifer and Alex.
Listen, man, that's a hell of a come up, because now you're a chef to the stars, so to speak.
You have these individuals who've made it super successful to be like their assistant or the house manager, that's one thing. But trusting somebody to cook your food every day, that's an important role, man. So without me doing the things that I need to do, I could hinder their success if I'm not feeding them the right way.
Welcome to another episode of the Real Mentors Podcast. Real, as always, stands for Real Examples Altering Lives. And today I'm privileged to have a personal friend, guest of mine, in the Bronx's own, Chef Jose, AKA the Trill Cooker. Welcome to the show,
me.
My brother.
Thank you for having me, Sean. It's been a long time, but I'm extremely happy to see you and be a part of your new journey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm blessed to have you here. It has been way too long.
Yes.
We met at a dinner at your house years ago. We shared some mutual friends, and I was instantly drawn to you. You got a great personality, and you can cook your ass off, too.
So thank you.
That always helps.
Listen, the chef's crib, honestly, that was one of my passions that I've manifested and talked about for years through like my journey working in restaurants, you know, and I had a bunch of chef friends that always believed in my dreams as well. And then, you know, I remember La Marina days when I spoke about the chef's crib and talked about doing dinners out of my house and stuff like that. And I think I talked about it for like 3 or 4 years before we actually made it happen. And my friends used to always be like, man, you're always talking about this, chef, but you never do it. And I think one day I was just like, you know what? I'm going to just do it. And I think taking that chance on myself really, really kind of like elevated me as a person, as a man, as a chef, as a father, as a husband. And it really kind of, it's almost like they inspired me with their words to like now just take a chance on myself. So besides yourself and Kathy and everybody who've been through the chef's crib, oh man, 3.5 years of meeting amazing, amazing individuals.
Tell us a little bit about the chef's crib and their rewind, because you mentioned La Marina and I didn't know that was part of your history. Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got to the chef's crib, and then we'll build on that.
Yeah. So, you know, born and raised in the Bronx, South Bronx at that, you know.
Whereabouts?
So I grew up on not too far from here, 149th Street and Wales Avenue. So
crazy.
Like, I remember growing up, my neighborhood was very family oriented. So like, you know, there was like, it was like big families in the neighborhood, right? You had the Jesuses, which was us. We had the Warbies, you know, so we had a bunch of families that we all just stuck together. We played SpongeBob outside together. We threw football games out there, roller hockey,
off memories.
The wall. So many memories. So like growing up in that neighborhood, we always had each other's back, right? And so fast forward, my parents moving out of New York City, my dad had an opportunity to relocate with his job at the time. So they relocated to North Carolina. And I think it took them like a year to relocate. But throughout that year, me and my wife, my sister, we were always visiting North Carolina because they were like house hunting and stuff like that. And I guess throughout those visits, it kind of hit me in my head. Like, you know what? I don't want to live in North Carolina. I like living, you know, in New York. I love the Bronx. At that time, I was like 18 years old. So for me, the Bronx was all I ever knew.
Right.
And then seeing something new, which don't get me wrong, North Carolina is
but it ain't the Bronx.
So people, I told my parents,
people don't understand that the Bronx is an amazing place.
It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. And I've seen a lot of beautiful places.
I love that because I mean, it's what makes me who I am.
Yes.
And there's so many flavors and cultures in the Bronx, and it just gets a bad rap because, yeah, we're the poorest borough. Yeah, we're the second smallest next to Staten Island. But we got Yankee Stadium. Yep. Yeah, we got Bronx Zoo. Yeah, we're the greenest borough.
Yes.
Yeah, we got, you know, Van Cortlandt Park, biggest park, I believe.
Yeah.
And then we've got Botanical Gardens, which is a 250-acre oasis in the middle of the greatest city in the world. And then we got all the other shit too, but that's what adds the flavor. The contrast, yeah, and the flavor to it.
But you know, people are scared. That's not really, like, they're scared of coming to the Bronx. But when there's a Yankee game on, they come into the Bronx, they taking that train, they're hanging out at stands, right? So like, come on, like.
Right.
That's not the only place in the Bronx that's beautiful, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, you also have the Andrew Freeman home, which is one of the big, like, one of the only mansions in the Bronx. So, like, we've done many dinners there, you know, like, pop-ups and stuff like that. So, for me, the Bronx is me, right? The Bronx is who I am. The Bronx is who made me who I am today. And the Bronx is who I'm going to continue to live my life through. And I'm forever grateful for, you know, my grandparents who moved out here when, you know, they came from Puerto Rico. And they made the Bronx their home. And thankfully, through them, I made the Bronx my home, and I'm making it my kids' home now, my family's home. But going to the beginning of how things happened, they moving to North Carolina. I told my parents, you know, I'm not moving to North Carolina. And during that time, Sean, I struggled a lot in school. Not necessarily because I wasn't smart, just because I was, you know, doing things that I shouldn't have been doing. I was like hanging out in the streets. I gave up on baseball. You know, at the time I was with my girlfriend, at the time who's my wife now. So I lost focus on the things that were really important to me and the things that I thought were going to make me, you know, somebody someday. Like, you know, I always thought I was going to be a big leaguer. You know, my Uncle Camacho, every year he put his time, his energy and his money into putting a team together for the kids in the neighborhood. Competitive team too. We played in St. Mary's, Crotona. We played all over. We played in Puerto Rico, Texas. And so I feel like at some point I let my uncle down. I let, you know, myself down because I lost focus in what he was dedicating his time to try to instill in us. And so because I wasn't the best in school, my parents, they were like, listen, you got to stay in New York. If you're going to stay in New York, you're going to do something with yourself. So thinking long and hard, you know, growing up, my mother never, I was never like the kid who was like, hey, I want to see my grandmother cook. I want to like my grandmother, my mom. Nah, like for me, it was like I was a taste tester. My mother was a phenomenal chef at home. My mother was a cook. She cooked out of cookbooks. She was a big TV, like, you know, chef TV watcher. Like, she loved Emeril Lagasse. You know, she loved these type of shows. She was inspired by these shows.
I think you even mentioned your mom, James Beard cookbook. Yeah, that was my mother's go-to, man. Yeah. My mother was another. I mean, how many Latina women? Shout out to all the Latina moms that filled our bellies proper, like, growing up. I mean, I remember just, damn, I'm missing that cooking right now. Just about it.
Me too. And honestly, like, I mean, my mother cooked she wasn't scared to cook any cuisine. She tried it at least. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, it didn't. So growing up as a taste tester, I guess I always had like a taste for food. I always knew like my mother knew if I said it was good, she already knew like, all right, this is going to be good tonight. And if I was like, eh, mine's all right. Like, you know, like she knew like, whatever, we're going to enjoy it, but she was never going to make it again. She was not making it out again. You know what I'm saying? And so I told my mom and dad, like, you know, I'm going to go to culinary school. I felt like at the time cooking was a thing where, no matter how good or bad things were in the world, people need to eat. You know what I'm saying? So it was something that was like a form of security for me, right? Like I felt like I'll be able to find a job as a chef, a cook, a dishwasher if I had to, I could run a restaurant if I needed to. And so I went to the New York restaurant school to, take up culinary arts and restaurant management. Cause I felt like, you know what, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to get my associates. And maybe one day I'll be able to run a business.
So just to clear that up for anybody who's listening, who's not familiar with the industry, this is essentially a 2-year program of sorts.
So ideally it's probably like a 1-year program. It took me 2.5 years. I was working full time. I was going to school part time. Like I said, my parents had already moved to North Carolina. I was living with my wife's family. So I was living with like her cousin in his place. You know what I'm saying? So,
Right. So like going part-time. Kind
yeah.
Of deal.
So I went part-time.
You gotta pay some bills.
I had to make. Exactly. And so 2.5 years later, I graduate. I start working at a restaurant in the city on the Upper West Side called West, O-U-E-S-T. It was a French restaurant.
Okay.
It was run by a chef named Tom Valenti. Well, he was the chef of the place, but the executive chef was one of my mentors, Chef Chadwick Greer, who believed in me from the beginning. I mean, when I started there, I was just washing lettuce and chopping onions. I wasn't really doing anything like, you know, where they can see my skill set. But he believed in me and he gave me a job after my internship right away. And I was there for 3.5 years. And you come from the Bronx, right? Where like in the Bronx, when you think about food in the Bronx, you're thinking about, I don't want to say fast food, but you're thinking about quick food, right? Like American Italian restaurants.
Right.
Such as Venice, where I worked at, right in my neighborhood. Pizza shops, the chicken spots.
Dominican spots, Puerto Rican spots.
Things that are like just very typical in the Bronx. So like when I'm working in a 2 or 3 star New York Times French restaurant for my first job, I'm cooking rabbits, squabs, things I've never even imagined. Yeah. Fish that I've never seen, like techniques that I've never imagined. And so I was so attracted to what they were doing in that kitchen that I was like, you know what? I'm gonna like watch and I'm gonna learn and I'm gonna help. And whenever I see you going down, I'm gonna jump in because I'm gonna watch so much that I'm gonna know exactly what to do. And in like 6 months, I went from interning to garde manger, which is like the salads cold appetizer station.
Okay.
To hot appetizers, to the grill in 6 months. And the grill was like the hottest and busiest station in the place. And then a year later, I'm basically what they call a tournant, which means I can work any station. So if, for example, if you were going on vacation, they could trust on me to take over the meat station, right, or the saute station or the fish station.
I want people to understand too, this is the importance of working your way up. You got to know how to do things from the ground up. And in a restaurant in particular, which is extremely, because you're at this high level, you know, not all restaurants, but you're fortunate enough. And I always say, God rolls out the red carpet for you when you step into your purpose, whether or not you knew it at the time. Now we know this is part of God's plan for you. And he's rolling out this red carpet for you, putting you in this very high level restaurant to start.
To start.
But you've got that hustle. You got that desire. And I'm tying in also, which I didn't know about you before, is the baseball background. So you know what it is to work hard. You know what it is to put in the reps, do the same thing over and over again. And you're not crying, bitching, or moaning.
Nah.
You're just showing up and doing what you got to do.
Every single day.
And you're flying through this process faster than the average Joe, I would imagine.
Yeah. And I was there for 3.5 years. And I felt like at that mark, I should have been like considered to be one of their sous chefs. But I think that because I was still so young in the industry, you know, it kind of hindered me into getting that next step in that specific place. Other places, maybe I would have been. Maybe they, you know, they would have, I don't want to say believed in me more, but maybe they would have taken the chance on me to be like, you know what, we're going to let you run, you know, this place for a little while and see like, you know, what ideas you come up with and things of that nature. So West for me was the beginning of what I feel was, so like cooking, right? When you're cooking, before you put anything in a pan, right? You gotta peel the onion, right? First, you gotta shop for the onion. You gotta make sure it's the freshest. Then, you know, you prep it, you chop it. So before you even get into like, you know, the oven or pan or anything really, it starts there, right? And I think that's what that was for me. That was my chopping block. It was like, hey, listen, you know what? This is where you're going to learn the basics. This is where you're going to learn how to properly saute, you know, how to properly treat fish. This is where you're going to learn, you know, or like your temperatures. I mean, bro, we were cooking pork chops,
right?
Two and a half, three inches thick and nailing them every single time. I mean, I can't remember food coming back in that kitchen.
Right.
You know, like, hey, can you recook this? Never. Like it was perfection every single day. And back then we were doing, I'm talking about, this is like 2003. We're doing 400, 500 covers a night from 5 o'clock to 10:30. I mean, we were putting in numbers in this place.
So this is high level.
Very high level.
High velocity.
Yes.
Not too much room for error.
No room for error.
And hence why you got to master the basics.
Yes.
Before you're going to be trusted with anything else.
Yes.
Because any one thing in that line goes wrong and that plate is at risk.
Exactly.
Sometimes I do this show and I know something about somebody, but I don't know everything about somebody. But it all makes sense because I see the passion that you have for it. And when you sit down the plates and you explain it to us with that big smile on your face and the passion comes through. But now I'm seeing where it comes from. So how long are you there at West before you decide or before life moves you to another step? So
right after those 3.5 years, once I saw I wasn't going up anywhere, and I already knew everything there, we were having my first child, my daughter. So we're having our first kid, my wife and I.
How long have you been together now?
We've been together 26 years, since 1998.
Damn, that's another point of inspiration that I've seen from you. You're a family guy through and through. Amazing relationship.
What I do is
typical
for her,
Puerto
for
Rican, been together since high school. Yeah. This is dope.
And my parents were a big part of that for me. My grandparents, you know, my aunts and uncles, you know, like, so they instilled in me love and honor and longevity. And
you're still close with them, if I'm not mistaken. Don't
course.
You guys all
yeah, we
share
all
the
still,
same address?
Yeah, we do. We do.
It's fucking amazing, man.
And so because we're having our first kid, I had to make a decision, Sean. And the decision at that moment was, do I go work for Michelin star restaurants like Jean Georges, a good friend of mine was there at the time, and make $9 an hour? Or do I go work corporate and make, you know, 25 an hour, weekends off, get out of work by 2? I'm able to help my wife out, be there for the baby. So I get a job at Deutsche Bank on Wall Street, 60 Wall, in their executive dining room. For me, that's where things started changing for me. It's Chef Louis Brañas, myself, and a pastry chef. At the time, we went through a few pastry chefs. Like I would say the first 6 months I was there, we went through like 2. And then we finally landed one that was there with me for the rest of my time there. His name was Jeremy Rose. Really good friend of mine still to this day. So we work at Deutsche Bank. We're basically catering to the execs in the building. Basically, it was a place where they didn't have to go have business meetings anywhere else. They didn't have to go to Cipriani down the block. They could come right upstairs. They can get a great meal just as good as Cipriani, if not better. And, you know, kind of host their people in their place of business.
Interesting.
And so we had different rooms there. It was mainly breakfast and lunch. But we obviously held a lot of dinner parties there. We did a lot of banquet parties. So a lot of, you know, cocktail parties where we did hors d'oeuvres and buffets and stuff like that. So it was a one-stop shop for me. Like, I was able to learn a lot there. And Louis Brañas is another one of my mentors back then, who worked. This guy was a Bolivian guy, came from Bolivia with nothing, worked as a dishwasher throughout New York City, worked his way up to the executive chef of Tavern on the Green,
wow.
Aqua V. And so he came into Deutsche Bank with all this, you know, knowledge and expertise, and was willing to basically teach me it all. And it was him and me. We worked hand in hand together.
And you're in a very unique environment.
Yes.
Because there's a small group as opposed to an assembly line with, you know, a dozen people. It's just the three.
It's just us three. And whenever Jeremy wasn't there, whenever he had vacation, I was working the pastry station. So it was a place for me where I learned everything. I mean, we did everything from scratch, butchering fish, butchering, you know, meats down, like portioning our stuff ourselves. Everything from soups, sauces, ice creams, desserts, everything made in house, cookies. I mean, for me, it was a place where I was able to kind of like, you know, say, you know what, I'm going to soak all this in. I'm going to save all this information and I'm going to use it for myself in the future. In fact, Sean, Louis was one of the chefs that I worked for where during this time there and then my time prior at West, all this knowledge that I'm getting from this kid in the Bronx, and I'm learning all these beautiful things with food, and I'm learning like, wow, food is actually dope as fuck. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is dope as hell. It's an art. I look at Louis one day, probably like I was there for 5 years, right? And I look at Louis one day, like probably my third year. And Louis also helped me with my mental.
Right.
You know, I was a knucklehead back then. Right. You know, I thought I knew it all. I thought, you know, nobody could tell me nothing, not even him. And this guy comes with extreme knowledge. And I'm telling him, like,
youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah, and I'm telling him, like, you don't got to tell me what to do. I know what I'm doing. Like, because I thought I was a badass. You know what I'm saying? And I was, but I let it get to my head too much at that time. And I remember Louis told me one time, he was like, listen, chef, you're amazing. Your taste buds are great. You're going to make it in this industry one day. But your attitude is what's going to hold you back. And you need to work on your attitude. If you want to get to the next step, you need to change your attitude. And no lie, Sean, for like 2 years, I worked on like controlling my anger, controlling my, so when like when you think too highly of yourself, like, you know, I was like, you know what? I got to humble myself down.
Need a humility.
Yeah, I needed to get humble like crazy. And for 2 years, I would like stop myself and be like, you know what? Nah. You know what, Chef? You're right. We're all going to do it that way. It's better that way. And I had to swallow my pride and be like, I literally have to change the way I think about life. Because it's not going to do it with my kid any good. It's not going to help my wife out. It's not going to help myself out. And anybody who I try to bring along on this journey with me, I'm going to end up hurting them rather than helping them if I continue to not fix the way I think about things in life and the way I express myself through my attitude, right? And so throughout those 5 years, worked on myself, not only mentally, physically. I started going to the gym. And he used to always tell me like, yeah, you can go to the gym for 2 months, but it's a lifestyle change. You got to go like every day. You got to change your diet. So there's a lot of things Lewis literally put in my mind. I mean, he used to always tell me like this one saying. He told me a lot of things, but one thing I'll never forget is like with my attitude, right? He would say, listen, if you're walking down the street, right? And you see a piece of dog shit on the floor, what are you going to do? Right? You got two options. You could either kick the shit to the side, continue to walk, but you're going to be mad as hell because now you're going to have shit on your shoe. It's going to smell. You're going to be smelly all the way till you get wherever you're trying to get to. Or you can just walk over it, keep moving and never look back. And that problem is never going to affect you because it was nothing. Mm. It was just that, right? And with that, I started saying, you know what? He's right. I'm not going to worry about problems anymore. I'm going to think about how can I resolve the problem rather than how am I going to let this problem affect me and my day?
Right.
Right. Which going back to sports, it makes you very, what is it when you put the same shoe on the same day and like you brush your teeth in the same manner. So like, oh man, what's that word I'm looking for? It'll come to me, but superstitious. I'm very superstitious.
Gotcha.
So I stopped letting my superstitions ruin my day. Right. So if I let the anger ruined my day and my superstitions take over. Now my day
becomes something
done.
That, right. It's taking your mind to a place of negativity and all of a sudden nothing's working out in your favor.
And it's done. And then you're downhill from there.
I just talked about this the other day. I had a bad start to the morning and I'm usually in control of that. But this one particularly got me out of sorts. And that shit just carried into not even the day, but like into the next day. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yo, you giving over control to something that you have no control over.
Exactly.
And that's what we were joking about with sports and why I'm not as invested as I used to be. Of course, I want the team to win. But if they don't, I'm not heartbroken.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't have skin in the game. I'm not the one on the field. And I'm not going to harp on the problem. So that's beautiful knowledge. He's taking you under the wing. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't say a father figure, but an uncle.
Uncle figure of sorts.
And we need that. And maybe those are things that even you didn't get, or maybe our parents weren't aware of because we're all flawed human beings. So this guy's taking not only your skill set to the next level, but your mindset to the next level.
And I'm forever grateful for Lewis. I mean, this guy, he put my mind in a place where I was able to do things like TV and the chef's crib and work privately for, celebrities and things like that. Without him, 2006 without Lewis from like 2005 to like 2010, things might be different in my career. Huh? Things maybe I'm still a line cook somewhere, just yelling at cooks and throwing pots and pans, right? Maybe right. I'm not the same.
And you're working someone else's dream,
exactly,
not your own.
Exactly. So
shout
out to Lewis Branyas. And I said, Lewis, one day I'm going to own a restaurant or I'm going to run a concept. Because the one beautiful thing also about Deutsche Bank, every day we had a new menu, right? So every day, a new salad, a new appetizer, a new soup, a new meat, a new fish, a veggie option. Usually the veggie option was like a pasta.
Right.
And then a new dessert, three new sorbets, three new ice creams every single day.
So this is
Monday
challenging,
Friday, so
but this is also a beautiful opportunity for growth that people in the industry are not going to get.
And so I tell him, hey, one day I'm going to do this restaurant where every day I change the menu or every week. And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, you're crazy. You're never going to do that. He's like, that's impossible. Like your food cost. And obviously it goes down to numbers now and money. And
right, of course.
And like, how to, like, it's
reminds
hard to
me
operate.
That show, The Bear.
Yes.
Where he's attempting to do that.
Yes.
And we got left on a cliffhanger, but nonetheless.
And so his lack of he believed in me so much, but that one little percent of disbelief and not believing that I could make that happen is what always stuck in the back of my mind, right?
Right.
And so fast forward, I'm there for 5.5 years. Lewis is like, listen, I would love to keep you here another 5 years, but you got to, like, it's time for you to move on. So he gets me a sous chef position at a David Burke spot. Well, he doesn't get me, but he kind of like, he's like, hey, this position is available. You know, go apply.
I just ate at a David Burke spot 2 days ago.
Oh, you did? Look at that.
And,
look
how full circle. White Plains at the hotel we were staying at. Holy shit.
And so I go and I apply and I go through the interview process and I get the sous chef position. And so it's like my first, even though at Deutsche Bank, I was technically the sous chef there because it was just him and me and the pastry chef. But this was like a real sous chef position, right? Where I'm managing, you know, probably 30 individuals and ranging from, you know, dishwashers to prep guys to
now, explain to our audience what a sous chef is and what role they play in the restaurant and the operations and everything, because some of our audience just may not know.
Yeah, so the sous chef is basically like the chef in charge of, like, so you have the executive chef, right, who runs all operations, basically food cost, labor cost, you know, menu planning, recipe development, things of that nature. Then you have the chef de cuisine, right? Then the chef de cuisine is the individual who creates the new menu items, who goes through the recipe testing, who basically does all the gritty work for the executive chef to taste and the higher ends to taste, to then like say, all right, it needs a little tweaking here and there, and then they actually put it on the menu or the specials or whatever it may be. And the chef de cuisine also runs the business with the sous chef, but the sous chef is right underneath the chef de cuisine. The sous chef also could create ideas if the place is that kind of place, right? Like, right. A lot of places nowadays, they even let line cooks come up with ideas and stuff like that. And they involve them because I feel like food nowadays is more of a creative space. So yes. It's different nowadays than it was back then. So the sous chef basically is like the captain of the ship of the day, right? So like he's in charge of making sure the stations are set up, making sure, everything tastes well for the day. So you have to run through every line and taste everything and make sure everything's up to par. And then typically the sous chef would be what they call the expediter, which means they expedite the night. So as orders are coming in, they're calling them out to the team and making sure things are coming out in order and making sure like the tables aren't waiting long enough. And when the food hits the window, you know, they're quality checking it to ensure that every single plate looks the same every single time. They may taste things here and there. The sous chef could also work a line. They could also maybe work the meat station or the saute or the fish station, depending on the day. So the sous chef has to be very well-rounded.
And flexible,
and they have to know the whole place. So if the chef de cuisine is out, they got to step in. But if the grill chef is out, they got to step in as well.
Gotcha.
If the prep guy is out, he might have to step in. So like it's a position where they depend on you a lot. You're going to work a ton of hours. So you're going to sacrifice a lot for the place. But hopefully, depending on the space, it's worth it, right? Like hopefully, if it's a really, really good spot, that time that you're putting in is worth the time and energy that you're going to be sacrificing.
So this is where you're at now, coming from this creative, very unique situation. You move into this new role of sous chef.
And it was great, man. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I remember my first week there, my food cost was like at 27%, which is not high. Like one thing Lewis always taught me, 30, 30, 30, 10. So 30% should go into food cost. 30% should be labor. 30% operational cost, right? So rent, gas, anything that takes to run your business, right?
Right.
And then 10% is money that you put away for a rainy day, right? Your oven goes down, your refrigeration goes down, you need to fix it. So 10% is usually towards that. And so my food cost was at 27%. So going by the 30-30-30 Lewis Brandon's rule, I was like, I'm not doing so bad for my first week. Mind you, first week there, executive chef goes on vacation, leaves me all alone.
Wow. So okay, trial by
first
fire.
First job, let me see if this guy's going to actually make it in this here today. So the GM comes to me. He's like, hey, chef, you know, your food cost was pretty high. You know, we need to do something about it. So the next week, I go crazy. I'm like counting how much we have in. And this kind of actually probably helped me with the chef's crib and the pop-ups, because I started pinching like the number so tight. So like if we didn't need like an extra case of whatever chicken, I'm not ordering it this week. Right. There's no need to have it in the fridge just sitting there for an extra 2 days if we don't need it. So I started like really making sure that everything we had in the fridge was what we needed for the next 2 to 3 days. And I bring my food costs down to like 20% the next week. Wow. Now the GM comes to me. He's like, my man, chef, how did you bring it down so fast? And I was like, well, you guys made it a big issue. So I had to like start cutting things down.
Yeah, left me here on my own. Told me I'm fucking up. What do you expect me to do?
Exactly. And so at that moment, I knew that this was going to be a challenge that I was willing to take on. Nice. And so I stood there for 6 months. I didn't stay there for that long. Honestly, the reason I left, not that the sous chef position wasn't for me. That place wasn't for me. It was taking a lot of my time. On my days off, they were calling me in. You know, so I remember waking up to phone calls, like on my days off, my wife being like, you really got to go in today. And I'm like, yeah, babe, I'm sorry. You know, I'm in charge there. I got to like, right. I worked probably like a month and a half with no days off because they kept calling me in. And
so this is like a managerial position? Salary?
Yeah, salary. Wow. So I'm not making any extra money. And so my wife was like, yo, babe, not for nothing, but you're going to have to find a new place because this is not going to work for that long. And so I was like, you know what? All right. So I put in my notice. Chef wasn't too happy, but I was like, listen, it's either your happiness or my happiness. And I think me and my family's happiness is more important. So I go, Chef, actually Jeremy Rose, who was the pastry chef at Deutsche Bank, him and his father-in-law, they buy a space in Nyack, a cafe. And so they're in the process of changing the cafe over and redoing the menu and stuff. So I call up Jeremy and say, hey, listen, you need help up there? And he's like, I would love your help. So I go up to Nyack for about a year and I just start helping Jeremy out. And we do a lot of the stuff that Louis Branyan's taught us there. So a lot of recipe development, we've made everything, you know, in-house so that his spot is, I don't want to say farm to table, but one of like a kind of like farm to table spot where everything
is. And this is early
on.
This is before this was a thing.
This was before this was a thing. So we really worked on making Temptations Cafe the spot to go to in Nyack. It was a family spot, nothing fancy. You know, it was really an ice cream parlor at first, and we turned it into more of and I say we because I helped Jeremy for a year, and then like, you know, whenever I can, I would help him out, whether it was through a phone call or whether it was me going up there and like having dinner and then conversations with him on how he could work on things. And Jeremy went from a pastry chef to running a business. And, you know, not that, you know, I don't want to say like, Jeremy is like also a mentor, basically what I'm trying to say, right? Because this is a kid who had no experience and did things that I did, right? Like believed in himself and took chance on himself and made things happen. And they owned the place for 10 years until recently, I think a year ago, where they sold the place. So, you know, kudos to Jeremy and John for not having any experience in running a restaurant like that and running one for 10 years and a very successful one. You know, this place had regulars, you know, had people who would literally not only eat there, but order takeout and take it home. So like he was doing a great job and every week he would have new specials. So, you know, I go up there, I do that for a year. I'm telling Jeremy, you know, all the things I want to do with like pop-ups and like doing my own thing. And I always wanted Jeremy to be a part of it. You know, I was like, Jeremy, like you're one of the only people I would love to like just leave this place and let's take over the world. We can open our own restaurant one day, you know, make it bigger and then open up chains and stuff like that. But he was always like invested into like helping out Temptations and his father-in-law. So I respect that. You know what I'm saying? He was loyal to that. And so I remember driving home a lot from Nyack, that long drive.
That's a decent drive.
That's a decent drive. A little 45-minute drive, hour drive.
I was over the tap before it was the new bridge, so yeah. It was a lot longer.
So I'm doing this drive, Sean, and I'm I get in my head a lot, right? So I think a lot. And my wife sometimes, she'll be like, babe, you know, you spend too much time thinking too much. And so I would do this drive and I would think of names for like my concept or my business or whatever, right? And I would think of names and I remember one day I'm driving in and the Knicks were doing well that year. And I remember they were doing like the Knicks tape. That's when they were like the Knicks tape. I don't know if you remember that. And so I'm driving and I'm like, chef's tape. Sounds good. And as I'm driving, I'm trying to think of like what tape means for me.
Right.
And it came to me and I'm like, talented actions, producing experiences. Mm. And I'm like, chefs with talented actions producing experiences. That's chef's tape. And so I get home, I'm excited as hell. I'm telling my wife, like, yo, I got it, baby. It's chef's team. I call up my, so my boy, Scott Aviles, chef as well. He's married to my cousin, Marsha. So Marsha's Camacho's niece. So I grew up with Marsha, PJ, Camacho. When my parents moved, my parents moved around the Bronx a lot, I always wanted to stay on Wales. So I lived with Camacho and on Sandra for a while. You know what I'm saying? To stay closer. So I always had a really great relationship with Camacho and Sandra and like Marsha and PJ. And so I call up Scott and I'm like, yo, bro, I got this idea. You know, I don't know if you're willing to like be a part of it with me, but we should like create a little catering company and like cater to like the Bronx and schools of the Bronx and like maybe like some businesses and do like little luncheons for them and stuff like that. Barbecues, whatever. Like, but it'll be a good way to get our like foot into like something different, right? And so Scott is like, yeah, I'm down. So we start the chef's tape. We get an LLC. I reach out to like a few people that I know who, you know, maybe are like, you know, teachers in schools or like they had some type of involvement in like local schools, charter schools. And we start working with schools and we start doing like little barbecues for them. And, you know, they had little budgets, so they would pay us their budgets. And usually the budget would cover like the food. But we would just want to do something for the community. We wanted to also try something different for ourselves, also right. See like if we were capable of doing these things. And then through that, through Chef's Tape, obviously it's not something where I could make a living out of at the time. So I go and I work for New York Presbyterian.
Okay.
I work for Greenberg South, which is like their VIP floor, 14 South. And I get this job there as a cook so I could pay bills. Also union, very good job where I'm able to like, you know, get some weekends off, you know, get out early enough where I'm able to
spend time with the family. Man. You got insurance, checking off all the boxes, security boxes.
Exactly. So I'm working at New York Presbyterian. I meet this guy there. His name was Elmir Mustafa, Moroccan chef. Older gentleman, very, very nice guy. Him and I come in at the same time. We both are line cooks. So we're working next to each other every morning. We both work the morning shift and, this guy, man, another mentor of mine. I love this man to this day. He came to New York for his kids, right? This guy was the chef of the Prince of Morocco, the number two guy. I remember him telling me he had a staff of over 300 people to run this guy's mansion or castle estate. Right. And he was the number one guy for the Prince of Morocco. And he left that to come to New York for his kids to have a better life in New York and a better education and took a job working at New York Presbyterian, making, I don't know, 20 something bucks an hour.
Wow. Let that be a lesson for anybody, and that's myself included, because when you're born in this pot of gold, you don't get to see it for what it is.
Yeah.
But this is a highly successful guy working for, obviously, one of the richest people in Morocco, and chose to come to the United States based on giving his kids a better future.
Yes.
I think that says everything about this place.
Yeah.
That the news wouldn't want you to believe.
No, and the one thing about Mustafa that I love the most is as soon as we like jumped on that line together, it was like two parts of different worlds, but we met in one space, right? And we became not only like best friends in the place, but he was teaching me things that I obviously, like I said, he's an old gentleman, very well seasoned. Oh my God, his experience was like, forget about it, like through the roof. So he's teaching me things that he knows. I'm teaching him things that I knew, didn't necessarily had to
different
be
different cultures. Cooking. So
just culturally, yeah, just like things about New York, things about like, you know, being out here. I used to talk about doing TV, not really, but like I would be like, yeah, you know, I don't really want to do TV, but like maybe through Chef's Tape. So through Chef's Tape, I met Chef Kelvin Fernandez, and so like. Because I met Chef Kelvin Fernandez, Chef Kelvin used to always push me to do TV. So like, that's why I talked about it to Mustafa, kind of like skipping in between there a little bit, but like through Chef's Tape, I'm working at New York Press, but throughout that process, I started telling Scott, like, you know what, let's join like underground cooking competitions. Let's put ourselves out there. So there was this competition out there at the time. It was called Culinary Fight Night. Chef Kelvin was a part of it. James Robinson, Chef JR, a few other chefs were part of it that had been on TV, whether it was being on Chopped or Hell's Kitchen, or they had done like some kind of TV work. So I told Scott, like, yo, I'm going to sign up for this and we're going to go up against these chefs. And not only for me, it was like a good way to network with individuals that have been in positions that are, you know, where I aspire to be at. But it was also a place for us to kind of like just cook and have fun and test ourselves, right? And see if we can create beautiful things. So we joined Culinary Fight Night. We get accepted. We do like 3 battles, and it was a pretty dope concept. They take over a restaurant. They build a boxing ring. The chef and his sous chef cook in the boxing ring, 3 courses for judge panel to taste. But then the people who buy tickets for the experience, who sit around the boxing ring, we have 2 sous chefs in the kitchen, in the back kitchen, creating the same meal so that everybody tries the food and everybody gets a 3-course dining experience.
And this is on television?
So it was, it wasn't televised, but they did record it. So like there was content on it.
Gotcha.
Never made it to TV, but it was a lot of content.
Where you working with? Right.
Yeah, yeah. So it was like a good
step
to
see
how it is to be like filmed and mic'd and stuff like that. And so we do this and we get to the championship and we go up against Chef Kelvin in the championship rounds. And we end up winning. We end up beating them. Mm-hmm. And I'm line cook at New York Presbyterian, who's taking a chance on himself. Kelvin is like a well-seasoned executive chef.
How does he feel about that?
Oh, he was torn. And then what made it worse.
I lost to the hospital chef.
Yeah, what made it worse, and not only that, the hospital line cook. And what made it worse was one of the chefs that I brought on with me wasn't even a chef. It was my wife's cousin, Gary, who just has a passion for food. The guy loves barbecue. So I'm the trail cooker. He's the grill cooker. So like the grill cooker's there helping me out, just like hands on deck. And so we beat them 3-4, really, because we went there with like one who wasn't really a chef.
Right.
And so they were torn. They were like, wow, this is crazy. And so Chef Kelvin was like, came up to me. He's like, listen, anybody that beats me is gonna be a friend of mine forever.
Nice.
So we just became like really good friends. And I end up leaving New York Press after like 2 years of being there. It's a good experience, though. I learned a lot about like, you know, dietary restrictions and different types of illnesses and how to like, you know, how to like build like different menus based on people's sicknesses and stuff like that. So overall, great place to work at. Met Mustafa, which was one of the best things about them. Mustafa is now the executive chef of Greenberg South. So he went from line cook and now he runs the place. So Kudos to him on not ever giving up, because it was rough. Can you imagine like making that sacrifice? So now he's the chef there. So he reached one of his goals. And so I leave there and I kind of do chef's tape a little bit more for full on now that I won. And I remember going, I go to La Marina to just have brunch with my family, and Chef Kelvin's there and he's like, hey, come on, let me talk to you. You know, I want to talk to you real quick. So we talking about like the place and how busy it is there for him. And he's expressing how he needs a sous chef. So he's like, hey, if you know anybody, let me know. And I'm like, you know what, bro? Like, send me the details. Maybe I'll come and help you. And so I end up taking an executive sous chef job at La Marina with Chef Kelvin for a season, and we kill it. We have a great season. We work there with an amazing line cook, like chef staff. Elio, Andy, David, Sean. I mean, that's really where we started building this like really close chef culture with the chefs that we were working with. And all those chefs have been a part of my chef's crib dinners, like Elio, Andy, they've all been a part of those. And so fast forward, La Marina, Chef Kelvin still pushing me to do TV. I'm still telling him, no, I'm not doing it. The season's over at La Marina. So I leave. I start working at Eataly as a chef de cuisine of the Il Pesce restaurant. Well, I start off in their pasta restaurant. I wasn't too happy after 3 months. I was going to leave. And they were like, hey, listen, we got something better for you. Just give us, you know, a few weeks. And they ended up moving me to Il Pesce like the next day. So
okay.
A few weeks went
for
the next day.
They didn't want to lose you.
And I ended up working there. I transform the place into like a really well oiled, like, you know, running machine. And the line cooks that were there, I had their back. They had my back from the beginning. Such an amazing group of individuals and chefs that work there.
This is like anything. It's about relationships, it sounds like. Yeah. So, I mean, I love the show because I love to get to know people on a deep level and how they got to where they were in their career. And I always tell the listeners who, you know, are hopefully young and open to learning that this shit does not happen overnight.
No,
I mean,
this
story's already, you know, encompassed over a decade.
Yeah.
Ups and downs. You know, taking left turns to worry about your family and get security. And, you know, here you are now getting a little closer to the dream.
Yeah.
And where you're at now. At what point did, you know, Chef's Crib come about and Trill Cooker and all the things that I know you for? Because you've got the resume now.
Yeah.
But I want to hear how we shift from now taking a job to taking that chance on our own.
Yeah.
Which is the scariest fucking thing. Because you've got these ideas for years.
Years I'm talking about them.
But you're not acting on them.
Not acting on them.
Because like so many of us.
Scared. Fear.
Ah, you hit it on the head. So I like to say.
You didn't want
to
fail.
The hunger that you have for more will quickly become the hunger that you had for more at some point.
Yes.
What's the catalyst? What gets you over the hump?
So I'm working at Eataly. I had applied for like TV shows, but never really made it on. So like Cutthroat Kitchen, Chopped, shows like that. I made it to like the interview process, but never made it on. So I was a little bummed by it. I was the backup chef for the Be Bobby Flay show for like a year. Meaning they had me in like backstage just in case one of the chefs didn't make it or cut themselves and that would go on. I probably had about like 5 signature dishes that I would go on if I needed to at the moment. So one day I tell my wife, like, you know what, babe? That's it. Once I see the next casting for Hell's Kitchen or Top Chef, I'm going to apply. I'm tired of like not doing things for me, right? Like I was always expecting the executive chef or the chef de cuisine to see something in me and then put me in a position. And I was like, why am I waiting for them to do it for me? I'm going to do it for myself. And so the next week at Eataly, I get an email. I never applied. I just told my wife. I just manifested it. And I told my wife, this is what I'm going to do. I get an email from Hell's Kitchen producers, casting producers, like, hey, we love what we see on social media. We would love for you to come and cast for season 18 and 19. 17 and 18. And at first I told them no. I was like, nah, going back to the fear. The fear hit. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, man, I talked about it, but I don't know if I'm about it, right?
You're talking yourself out of it.
But also, I was running like a $4 million restaurant. My sous chef at the time was going through a hard time. Her dad was really sick. So she had like, she was out for like 6 months. So I was assuming a lot of responsibility in the place. They reached out to me like probably 4 times before I said, yes, I'll go cast. I said, you know what? I'll go do it. So I go cast. I remember it was like on like 30-something street in the city in like a hotel. And I'm camera set up right in front of me. And I'm just answering questions that they're asking me offside. Leave the place. Felt really confident about the interview. Next week or so, I get an email saying that I went to the next process. So eventually, through that casting, through that email that I got, through that manifestation of me telling my wife, I end up casting for season 18 of Hell's Kitchen. I remember it like it was yesterday, man. I'm at Eataly. I get this email. Open it. It's like you've been selected to cast for season 18. Your next thing is gonna go to LA to like thing. Call my wife right away. Yo, it's crazy, babe. I got casted. Call my mom. Like somebody who, like I said, I had no aspirations in life. I wasn't accepted to no colleges. I graduated high school with like a 65.3 GPA. All 4 years combined.
It said 65.3 until the second register.
It's probably accurate. It's accurate. I found my transcripts like 7 years ago. I looked at them like, yo, oh, babe, look at this.
I want a copy of those. We're going to post them.
Yeah, I know my wife has them somewhere. And so we find these and I'm like, wow, I barely made it. And
anybody who's doubting themselves because school's not validating you. Listen to this.
You validate yourself at the end of the day. And so, you know, I go off to LA, I film. Filming was a very tough process. because you're secluded from the world. There's no phones, no TVs. So I'm not in communication with my family for about 2 months. So that was tough mentally, physically. So I go through Hell's Kitchen. I come back. When I come back, I'm on the plane. I land. I'm in an Uber heading home. As soon as I get home, I tell my wife, if I can go through that experience, Chef's Crib is going to be nothing. So we start Breaking Bread Kitchen. And we had just remodeled the house. So the kitchen, everything was like kind of like the way we wanted it. And she was like, babe, why don't you just start them here? We already like have everything ready. And I was like, you know what? You're right. We're going to start them here. I'm going to stop looking for places and we're going to do them at home. So I just started inviting people over. And that's when like, so it started off as the Breaking Bread Kitchen, where you break bread at table together, right? You're breaking bread with the chef in his home and things of that nature. So, you know, we started Breaking Bread Kitchen. It evolved from doing dinners in my home, 7-course dinners, to expanding through the Bronx, right? For me, my pop-up was about me and my food and stuff like that. And it was about my guys and my chefs that worked with me alongside me. But it was more about showing people that the Bronx was beautiful. For me, that's what was more important, right? Like Chef JR, a good friend of mine, was like, hey, listen, if you want to make it in this industry, move to like Austin, Texas. You're going to be the man there.
Right.
But I was like, the Bronx needs me more than Austin, Texas needs me.
Amen.
And so I start this in the Bronx. Man, we do dinners all over the Bronx. Bronx Brewery, Gun Hill Brewery, Motley's Kitchen. We take over there. We do Sunday nights there. The chef's table. 7-course dinners right in front of me, you know, on Sunday nights. We end up doing My Haven Bar and Grill with the Bronx Public on the west side of the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And we're just taking over. We're just like, we're on this like hot run, right? It's like a sports team that's, you know, on this streak. They're in the playoffs. They're making it to the right. World Series or the finals, the Super Bowl, right? Like we were hot. And so the heat got shut off with COVID. Just like shut everything down. And so now we're looking at each other like, what do we do? I mean, I had people still reaching out, but I didn't want to be a part of the problem. I wanted to be a part of the problem that was solving the problem, not making it worse, right? So I couldn't do anything. I think I went like 6 months just home, cooking at home, making drinks at home, like content at home.
Right.
So even though it was a rough time, it actually taught me some things, right? Like how to work a camera, how to edit, you know, how to film, how to like come up with, creative ideas to keep people interested on social media.
Right.
It helped me elevate my social media. And so fast forward during that time, thankfully though, right before COVID hits and Chef's Crib is, and everything is down, I meet, but Chef Kelvin is working for Jennifer Lopez and Alex Rodriguez. And he's like, hey, listen, you know, I would love for you to come help me. And I'd rather you come help me than anybody else because I know you'll be able to handle this. So I talk to my wife, and my wife's like, yeah, you never made any big sacrifices. You never worked at any Michelin restaurants. You never did anything for yourself because you always did everything for the family.
Nice.
So this is your time to sacrifice. And our kids were older now, right? My son is now like probably 5 at the time or 6. You know, my daughter was 11. They've already seen me do things for myself. They've seen me be on TV. So it was already a lot. It was already inspiring for them. But this level was like, all right, I'm going to take this chance, but I'm not going to see you guys a lot. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so I start helping Chef Kelvin. We do the first season together. We do like, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and boom, February. That's when everything hits, right? And then prior to that, we were doing the Chef's Crib. And the reason we were doing the Chef's Crib is because we weren't doing Molly's Kitchen anymore. I wanted to keep it more intimate. And I felt like changing the name because I felt like calling it Breaking Bread Kitchen is like going backwards. Right. I wanted to recreate it.
I met you right before COVID then.
Yeah.
That was the right first before. Time.
That's right when we transitioned the Breaking Bread Kitchen.
Because I remember when you started working with Kelvin for J-Lo and A-Rod. And then as I always affectionately joke, A-Rod got you in the breakup.
Yeah.
But listen, man, that's a hell of a come up. I mean, hell of an opportunity now.
Yeah,
now you're a chef to the stars, so to speak.
So now I go from doing dinners for 8 guests in my house to cooking for Jennifer and Alex, you know what I'm saying? And their families and staff and
the ancillary people that come along with that.
And so I was like, I went from one extreme to the next. And that February, that's when COVID hits. So we don't see them for probably till September. When we see them in September, Chef Kelvin me and Chef Kelvin go up there for like about 4 days, 4 day weekend or something like that, a 3 day weekend. I remember it was like Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We coming back Sunday. So we're driving back Sunday together. Kelvin's like, hey, they need you to come back next week. I can't come, but they want you to come. So I'm telling Kelvin, like, nah, bro. Like, that's messed up, man. You needed me to help you. Now you're going to send me to the wolves alone. Like, like you setting me up for failure. Like, this is a high level position. Like, it's not that easy doing this, right? Like how come you needed me? Now you think it's okay for me to go alone? But Kelvin was like, nah, I believe in you. And he goes, and I know. And Kelvin looks at me in my eyes on the drive. And he goes, I know that you're going to take this away from me. Like, you're going to take this opportunity away from me, but I'd rather it be you than anybody else.
Wow.
And if it's you, at least we still have it in our circle together.
Right.
So it's still, even though you take it, it's still going to be ours, because whenever you're not around or whenever you can't, I'm going to be the one who's going to be able to go.
Right.
Right. So it's still something that we can collaborate
on. So egos are not a thing here, which is beautiful, because, you know, if you got a team, that's what it's all about. And yeah, Nobody's hating on the other person. Exactly. You know, he gave you an opportunity and now that opportunity might be yours. And he's like, yeah, bro, take it without any hesitation.
Exactly.
So shout out to him for
shout
having
out to
that. Yeah, having
another
that lack
one of
ego.
Mentors. Another one of my mentors, not only in the kitchen, to be honest, mentor, television-wise, like pushing me to do TV. I remember when I get casted for Hell's Kitchen, I called him. And he was like, what the hell, bro? Like, I told you to do like Chopped, a one day show, not a show where you're going to be away from your family.
Right.
And so mentor for like pushing me to do television, mentor, obviously as a chef, mentor, social media wise, like, you know, what it takes to build your social media and like, you know, being, you know, an influencer and things of that nature. So on many levels, Chef Kelvin has inspired me to be better, do better, want more. More life, things of that nature. So, go do the 10 days. They love it. They ask me to come back for another 14. I tell them, hey, listen, Kelvin's your chef. Reach out to him. If he's available, then we'll both be here. If he's not, then I'll just come and no problem. I don't mind doing it again. He's not available, so I go do the 14 days. On the 13th day, Jennifer basically like telling her staff, like, hey, I want Chef Jose to be my full-time private chef. I want him to travel everywhere I go. And I remember her telling, you know, her staff on email, like, hey, I don't care what you got to do, but like,
make it happen.
Make it happen.
How does that make you feel?
Oh man, I get goosebumps. Like, for someone who never believed in themselves a lot throughout their life, you know, like, for someone who grew up in an area where like you don't have many mentors, you don't have many people pushing you. For a kid who like only aspiration was to be a Major League Baseball player and didn't really have anything else to fall back on, and then falling into food the way I did, it's one thing to get an email to cast for television and go do that and accomplish that and be challenged and go through those motions. It's another thing to have somebody of such a high level who you growing up admired, you'd watch their stuff and listen to their music from the Bronx. Like, you know, obviously too, you know, she's with Alex, who's not from the Bronx, but plays for the Bronx team, you know, yeah. Bronx Bomber and
Dominican originally from the city.
Yes, like you have these individuals who've made it at such a high point in their lives, super successful, and they want you to like be that. And cooking, all right, somebody to be like their assistant or the house manager, that's one thing. But trusting somebody to cook your food every day.
Right.
Like the fuel that you need to do the things that you need to do, whether it's business-wise or a show that you're performing or a movie that you're doing. That's an important role, man. That's putting somebody in a big position to help guide you through the things that you need to do to be successful, right? So without me doing the things that I need to do, I could hinder their success if I'm not feeding them the right way. If they're not liking the food that I'm producing, right. You know. So it's a very tough position to be put
in. And you're still having this internal battle. There's still some doubt. Am I good enough? And that's the human struggle.
Of course.
Am I good enough?
I remember, man, like I would go home. Man, knock on wood. I crushed it every day in 5.5 years. Well, 2 years together when they were together, but every single day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, when I worked, Sean, I worked like no days off.
At the time, one of the most famous couples.
I didn't have 2 days off a week. I didn't have a day off. If we were in LA, I was working like 2 months straight. So like the sacrifice, the mental breakdown, physically having to like work late hours, wake up early. Stress.
Being away from the family.
Being away.
But having this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
The support was there, but the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity was what kept me going. And so, you know, I was on cloud nine. Still am to this day. I mean, I'm still, you know, I've let my insecurities in a way help build my courage, help build my belief in myself more than I ever did. Obviously with the support of my wife, my kids, her family, my friends, the chefs that I've known throughout my career. They all supported me immensely. So turning all of those negative things into such a huge positive motion was huge, you know? And then I go on and thankfully I go back and I start working for Alex, you know, after things happened between them and super, you know, it was only supposed to be for a little while and then it ended up being 5 years working with Alex. To this day, you know, still, you know, helping out Alex whenever he needs. And for me, it's just something that I never imagined in my life. Like when I first went to culinary school, when I told my mom, like, you know, I'm not moving to North Carolina because I want to cook. I never thought that food would put me in a position in life where I'm at now. I never thought that I would be as good as I am when it comes to, you know, my art, my craft, my creativity, my passion, my love for food. I never thought any of those things. I just needed a job. I just wanted to work and I wanted to like not have my mother and my dad like down my throat about not being
and
anything.
Disappointed in you.
Yeah.
So food is the vehicle, but there's something creative in you. There's obviously a work ethic and a desire for more. You know, you're A-Rod's personal chef now. He got you in the breakup, like I joke. I saw something cool on social where he signs over an autograph a jersey for you. What was that exactly?
Yeah, so basically, one of my cousins, he's a big A-Rod fan, big Yankee fan. When they won that chip, he got that jersey. It's funny, his Instagram is like also J-Rod. So he hits me up on social media and he's like, hey bro, like I know it's been years, but I love what you're doing. Like this is incredible. He's like, I have this jersey and I would love for you to have it. And the only thing I want is a picture of A-Rod signing it. That's all I want. You can keep the jersey. I just want him to sign it. And I want the memory of the picture of him signing it. And I'm like, nah, bro, like, I can't do that to you. Cause like, send me the jersey. I'll have him sign it. And I'll just send it back to you. That's your jersey. Like, that's, and he's like, no, I want you to have it. I'm telling my wife, like, I'm going to just, secretly send it back to him.
Right.
So he sends over the jersey, and I think it took me like 2 weeks to ask Alex to sign it. I don't know why. I just like was, I guess, a little nervous too. Like, I've never asked Alex for anything. I'm not there. Like, what people don't understand is this is a business. I'm his chef. Like, I'm not a friend. I mean, yeah, we grow along because we spend so much time together. But like, at the end of the day, I'm there to perform a job. And my job is to make sure that, you know, he's fed throughout the day and make sure that his diet is kept and I'm on top of the things that he needs me to be on top of to make sure that his day goes by the way it needs to go through. And so it's hard for me to just go up to Alex
and be like, can you sign this for me?
Because I'm not a fan. Like, yes, I'm a fan, but I'm not there as a fan.
Right, I work with you, waiting in line to take a selfie. I'm the same way. I can't ask him. I just saw Patrick Ewing at a hotel I was staying at the other day, and I had to say hi. So, excuse me. So I just want to shake your hand.
Yeah.
And that's it. I moved on. But, I saw other people taking pictures, just not me. And then you obviously have this other thing because you're working for him. And you don't want to ask, but you get up the courage to ask him.
And I get up the courage, and he's like walking through the house, and I'm like, hey, Alex, I have this jersey. Cousin of mine sent it. Can you sign it? I was like, but the only thing is they would like a picture of you signing it. And Alex is like, take a video of me signing it. And I'm like, all right, even better. Because I could record you and then do the little snaps and like still get a picture out of it. So Alex, you know, he does his spiel. He starts talking about it, signing the jersey, talking about that World Series and how important it was for him and the Yankees and the Bronx and the fans and things of that nature. And I'm just recording it. And I'm like, oh, shit, I got him to do it. Like, this is awesome. And so he gets the jersey signed. I hit up my cousin Jay, and I'm like, yo, I'm gonna send this jersey back to you. And he's like, nah, if you do that, I would never talk to you again. Like, I really wanted you to keep it. So I kept the jersey. So I got the jersey signed by Alex, you know, World Series signature. Thank you, J-Rod. Yeah. I appreciate you. I wish you could have the jersey. You know, it's yours ultimately, but you know, I appreciate the gesture and I get it. He wanted me to keep it because it's a memory. It's like a memory for me.
I think he's proud of you.
Yeah.
Cuzzo.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, his cousin that came from the same shit that he came from is now in a position like that. And it, you know, again, you know, we don't have to aspire to be, you know, filthy rich or, you know, do these amazing things. But that in and of itself is an amazing thing because just hearing your journey and how far you've come to be able to do something like that. And then, you know, it means so much to your cousin. But then at the same time, he unselfishly says, nah, you keep it.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing. It seems simple.
Yeah.
But it's awesome. Not because it's a testament to how far you've come.
Mm-hmm.
It's a testament to now you're surrounded by not only high level chefs, but high level human beings.
Yeah.
Because off camera, we talked about, you know, the rumors I hear about A-Rod as a business person. There's absolutely no doubt this man is going to be an absolute monster. I mean, there's a reason he's on Shark Tank. There's a reason when he goes to these events, these masterminds, I heard he's just like a student, like anybody else, taking notes. I mean, he's got such an amazing reputation as a business person. Well, and now you're kind of in that circle. Mm-hmm. Have you picked anything up? And also, have you alleviated some of that imposter syndrome or that lack of belief that we all suffer with, that I'm not good enough feeling?
Yes. A lot of that is behind me, almost like the Louis Branagh's saying about the piece of shit on the floor, right? That piece of shit was my fear. That was my fear of failure, my insecurities. So a lot of that is behind me. Obviously, we all, if I'm doing a dinner for 8 people in my house, Sean, my anxiety is still high. I mean, I love what I do, right? I don't want to, I want to give people a great experience, whether it's, you know, 8 strangers in my house, 40 strangers in a restaurant, celebrities, whoever it is, my family, if I'm cooking for my family, like the anxiety is always going to be there. And I feel like if you do something you love that you're passionate about, you're always going to get those like butterflies.
Right.
Because you care.
Absolutely.
And I care so much about what I do. And how I do it and the way I do it, that I, like I said before, I'm an overthinker. I think about the motion so much. Right. I think about, you know, I think about when the steak is going to hit the pan and how I'm going to plate, you know, the fish course and how it's going to be perceived by whomever it is that's, you know, enjoying this.
Right.
Are they going to enjoy it?
Right. I can say with all honesty that I've never had anything that you've served me that I didn't enjoy. So, you know, my personal experience with you, now I'm piecing it together. The timeline, you know, we meet you at Chef's Crib. Shout out to Kat, one of my great friends, who introduced us and has always been a huge supporter of you. I think you met her back in the New York Press days. Is that where?
Yeah. So basically, Kathy and my wife used to work together.
There you go. Okay. That's
years
the connection.
Ago. And so I'll tell you one thing, Kathy, Myrna, the people that she worked for in East River Medical, those individuals, that was the only job that my wife ever worked at where her coworkers and myself became really good friends. I mean, dinners, nights out to just hang out, obviously Chef's Crib events. I mean, I'm forever grateful for my wife and East River Medical and meeting those and meeting Kathy and them people, because they're like great friends of mine, and right. and the only relationship I have with them is through my wife's work. So right. for but us they, to be such good friends.
She's good people. She's genuinely supportive. They want to see you win.
Win every
and we
day.
See a lot of people, unfortunately, in our neighborhood that want to tear us down.
Of course.
But, you know, this particular person we're talking about wants to see you win. I know that for a fact. She's got a great
she's
heart.
She's awesome.
We ended up doing my 42nd birthday in the backyard of my crib.
That was awesome.
And we had you over. And this is during COVID. Boy, that turned into a shit show, but it was a good fucking time. Yeah. Boy, I tell you, the food was amazing.
Thank you.
I think we had maybe 14, 16 people, something like that. Pool party. Oh my God. I just remember
the light, the fire.
We had the fire. Oh my goodness. Yeah. This is going to make for a good reel. Yeah. When my editor gets a hold of this, because I think I still got that footage. We had the fire dances. The fire dancers ended up hanging out with us.
Yes.
I won't get into too much detail, but it
we
was
had a great night.
Great
they ate good right night. After that because we had some leftovers. Everybody ate.
And that's what food does, right?
Yes.
It brings people together.
Yes.
And I had a chef on season one. Shout out to Chef Christina, who, you know, we talked about the origins, and that's where the community would get around the fire, going back to the prehistoric days, and build community and, you know, just tell stories.
That's what it's all about.
And, you know, get closer, because human beings are your greatest resource, and communities are what keeps people together. It's what gives everything meaning. And then food as the central piece of that, bringing everybody to the same table. And I got, you know, I got a family now. And unfortunately, you know, we don't eat around the table as often as maybe we should. And even as a chef, that doesn't happen, right? We just grab a plate and go.
And just go. I eat standing up every day.
That's crazy.
Unless we're seating at a restaurant, but I'm eating standing up.
Yeah, I need to do a better job of that.
Same.
Because when we do, it's beautiful.
Same.
And, you know, my kids, I just realized something. You know, my kids get up and kind of jump around, and they don't have the table manners that I would wish for them to have. But I got to look at myself and be like, why is that? It's because we don't have a ritual of sitting down at a table every night as a family. You know, maybe we're going old school here. I don't know. But those old school things are beautiful things. And they mean a lot, because that's where you're going to get to know about how your children's day was, or how your wife's day was, how your husband's day was. That's where conversations are have, you know, futures are drawn up.
Yeah.
And shit, I got to do a better job with that.
I would say that's some of the things that I've gotten. So a few things that I've gotten from, you know, the people I've worked for, is one of those is that sitting at the dinner table every single night with your kids and discussing things like that, like how things are. And those values are super important. You know what I'm saying? And also for me, it's like you see people and celebrities of this caliber, right? And a lot of people from the outside would think that people who are super rich don't work as hard as people who don't have the means, right? That live paycheck to paycheck and have to work every day. And so when you're in there and you see somebody who has everything, but gets up every morning at 6 a.m., goes to the gym to work on themselves, instills family values, operates on many different businesses in the 24 hours that they have, is a student of the game, like you said, taking notes every single day. That's one thing that a lot of the people that are in that circle always say about him, is that he's a student of the game every single day. And when you sit there and you're looking at all these things and you're a part of them every single day, if you don't get something from this, if you don't get like those type of, if those things aren't instilled in you, like being a student, like for example, every day I'm watching, like, I've never worked at Michelin restaurants, so every day I'm watching like on YouTube, like Michelin content, right? I'm watching Michelin starred recipes, or I'm watching Michelin restaurants and how they operate and how the chefs come up with, like, you know, dishes with their team and how like the service goes. And my wife is like, why are we watching this boring stuff? And I'm like, because I'm like trying to educate myself right now. I've never worked there. And, you know, I'd rather watch a series too, where it's more exciting and more fun. But these things are like things that are exciting to me.
And right. And you're growing. And you're growing. Investing in your future. So you're still learning. You have this good fortune of being placed around a very high level individual in A-Rod. And you'd be a fool not to pick up on some of the habits.
Exactly.
And you'd also be a fool to not appreciate the fact that this guy's still got a hunger as if he had nothing.
If he had nothing.
And that's an inspiration, because me having accomplished some level of success got lazy as fuck for a long time because I was just resting on my laurels. But then I turned it in and was like, all right, I'm going to dedicate this time to the family. And now that they're good to an extent, I'm going to move on and do this thing. And I think you got a bit of the same, which is you're never going to stay the same.
Yeah.
So what's next for Trill? And, you know, where can our audience find you? How can they support? And how the fuck can they eat some of that great food, bro?
Well, so, you know, the beautiful thing about life is that we never know what's next. Things could change. I didn't know TV was going to happen. I didn't know that I was going to have the courage to, you know, start, you know, the pop-up dinners and the chef's crib and the chef's table and the chef's bar and all those beautiful concepts. You know, I never thought that I was going to work and travel and cook for celebrities and people of high status like that. I never knew any of those things. I didn't plan any of that. That was just a beautiful thing about working hard and believing in yourself and being prepared for what's next to come. So I think for me, it's like whatever's next, I'm going to be ready for it. You know, hopefully I one of the biggest things that I've been talking about and manifesting for years as well too, is like owning a brick and mortar, owning a restaurant, you know, whether it's like a gastropub style or something a little bit more finer or something that's just like a space, like a warehouse in Hunts Point or somewhere where, you know, we set up 15 seats and a man-made man-made kitchen, nothing too, you know, too fancy. And we just curate dinners in there. And so I don't know. I mean, any of those would be beautiful, you know, a beautiful new thing to kind of like take on a new challenge for me. I would hope that in the next 5 years, you know, I could with the skill set I have and the knowledge and the experience, I would hope that we're able to round up some investors and open up something really nice in the Bronx, and then go from there. I think my focus now is on simplicity of food and nothing too crazy, right? Like nothing too complicated, keeping it simple, working with farmers markets out here and just producing really nice food and great cocktails and keeping things very, very, what would you say? Kind of like micro, man, like micro. So like, for example, working with places like the Gun Hill Brewery and instead of working with big corporations. But I would say hopefully that you can book me on 111corp.com. That's 111, that's oneelevencorp.com. You can go on there. You can book me for private dinners. You can book me for business events, business dinners, cocktail parties, whatever it may be, barbecue events. If you want to host a barbecue when the weather gets better,
we're doing another one soon.
If you needed me as a private chef and you were traveling somewhere, you needed somebody for a week or a weekend, you can book me through there as well. You can find me on Instagram at cooker. But you could also look forward to me hosting some stuff throughout the Bronx.
Yeah.
Or Queens. Or Brooklyn. I think now I'm at a point where I kind of want to do things in other places. Just because, I don't know, I want to have more fun with it. I want to bring more recognition to other beautiful places that have also helped me throughout my career, like the Trestle, who years ago, you know, I just went in to help revamp their menu. And when I called him looking for a space to do a dinner, he opened up with open arms, the Trestle, so we can go in there and perform and do what we do best, right? And that's created a beautiful experience for the beautiful people that we just love having at our events. And I will say, I think you've heard this before at some of the dinners. The reason I am so passionate, the reason I am so in it to win it when it comes to my career and food and whatever it is that I do, whether it's private chefing, private dinners, pop-ups, cooking for my fam. Food changed my life. From the moment I went to culinary school to this day right now that we're sitting here speaking, food has been a big part of my life. It has literally put me in places that people can only imagine or dream of. And I've been extremely lucky to have lived those out, like with these eyes that I've never thought would see things like that. So because food has changed my life, nowadays I try to use food to change other people's lives. Whether it's through nostalgia, whether it's through following a healthy diet plan to help them get through their daily lives, whether it's through just coming out to enjoy a nice dinner with Chef Trill in my house or in a location. So for me, I try to use food as a positive, and I try to push as much as I can with food, whether it's influencing the chefs behind me to take chances on themselves. But I am forever grateful for my mentors who helped me. I am forever grateful for my wife and my family and my kids, my friends, people like yourself, Sean, people like Kathy, and anybody who's entrusted in me and my dinners to be a part of them and have come through. I mean, every single one of you, I couldn't be more grateful.
Bro, I appreciate you, brother. I look forward to us doing it again sooner than later.
Yes.
So I'm going to definitely take you up on that. We're going to put all of Trill's information in the credits, in the bio. So make sure to stay tuned. As always, thank you for tuning into the Real Mentors podcast. Thank you to our guests today. You know where to find them. And as always, let's get it, baby.
Yeah, let's get it. Thank you.
Thank you, my brother. Appreciate you, brother. That was awesome.